we will not have enough salmon to meet the lower bound sockeye salmon escapement goal, and therefore we've had to close these two fisheries.
Dip netting on the Chittenah River is closed. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Attorney General's zero-tolerance policy on illegal border crossings gets a cool reception from Senator Murkowski.
If we're talking about young children here, young families, and a forced separation for an indefinite period of time, I have concerns about it.
Those stories and more tonight, Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
There's more bad news for dip netters and sport anglers in South Central Alaska. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced Wednesday that it will close the Chittenah River to dip netting due to this year's abysmal sockeye return to the Copper River. Fish and Game will also close sport fishing for reds in the upper Copper River drainage. Fish and Game's Mark Somerville manages both fisheries.
And the main reason for that is that escapement past the sonar at Miles Lake is so low at this point, it's indicating that we will not have enough salmon to meet the lower bound sockeye salmon escapement goal, and therefore we've had to close these two fisheries.
The closures will take effect Monday, but subsistence fishing will remain open on the Copper River. Dip netting opened on the Chittenah just 10 days ago, and the season was set to run for the next 2.5 months. Somerville says closing the fisheries is unprecedented. The Chittenah River personal use dip net fishery attracts up to 8,000 Alaskans, and Somerville says the sockeye sport fishery in the upper Copper River drainage typically averages about 15,000 angler days. Roughly 180,000 fish have returned to the Copper this season, putting it on track for the 8th smallest return on record. But there is a silver lining for sport fishermen. Low sockeye numbers have also shuttered the commercial gillnet fishery near the mouth of the Copper River, which Somerville says should increase opportunity for king fishing upriver.
Right now, with the commercial fishery closed, the king salmon return to the Copper River appears to be at or above our forecast of 43,000. I expect king salmon sport fishing to be spectacular this year.
There will also be a bright spot for commercial gill netters. Fish and Game commercial fisheries biologist Jeremy Boat says a late sockeye return to the Copper River Delta could provide opportunity in the commercial fishery.
Starting in about mid-June, we start to do kind of a hybrid between managing for our Delta sockeye and our upriver sockeye. If we're tracking at daily anticipated, it's for this later component of the upriver, plus, you know, we're meeting Delta sockeye salmon escapement objectives, and, you know, there's a chance we could have the fishery open, you know, before the coho salmon season starts.
Boat says opportunity would be limited if the commercial fishery does reopen, and whether that happens will still largely depend on the number of sockeye that make it upriver. Senator Lisa Murkowski said today she's troubled by the Trump administration's practice of removing children from their parents when a family is caught crossing the border without authorization.
If we're talking about young children here, young families, and a forced separation for an indefinite period of time, I have concerns about it.
She said the separations are especially worrisome when there isn't a clear process or a focus on the needs of small children. Attorney General Jeff Sessions last month announced a zero-tolerance policy for illegal crossings at the southern border. He warned that parents will be jailed and their children detained separately. Sessions defended the policy again today, saying consistent enforcement of the law is good and moral. He says the parents are to blame.
They are the ones who broke the law. They are the ones who endangered their own children with this trek.
Sessions also describes the separations as short.
Normally, the adults are only held in custody for a week or two or three before they would enter a plea of guilty for time served and allowed to go home and with their children.
A spokeswoman for Don Young said the congressman believes detaining people who cross illegally is important to border security, but he thinks there are solutions that can keep families together. Senator Dan Sullivan's office did not respond by our deadline. With his signature yesterday on the state's capital budget, Governor Bill Walker committed $21 million to the Juno Access Project. But back in 2016, the governor had decided against building the ever-controversial road mega project, citing the state's fiscal crisis. KTOO's Jeremy Shea looks into why the road money was spared the veto.
Business interests, environmentalists, politicians, and neighbors in Juneau, Haines, and Skagway have gone round and round for years on whether or not to build the road, including Denny DeWitt, head of the pro-road First Things First Alaska Foundation, and attorney Buck Lindekugel with the environmental group Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
We're delighted that the money was left in the budget.
We are disappointed by Governor Walker's decision not to veto this dead-end project.
It's back where it belongs, and gives us an opportunity to continue working on an important project for Juneau.
But we urge him to continue to press his DOT commissioner to issue a decision selecting the no-build alternative this summer and address our other pressing transportation needs expeditiously.
They're referring to money lawmakers cobbled together for the road late in this year's legislative session. It came from past unspent transportation earmarks for Upper Lynn Canal. It's a small victory for road supporters, but there are still major hurdles to get to construction, like securing huge federal grants, which largely hinges on reversing Governor Walker's 2016 decision not to build the road. The governor's spokesman, Austin Baird, says Walker's policy on the road isn't shifting. He says the governor didn't veto the road money because it didn't draw from new general fund money. Previously, state plans called for extending Glacier Highway in Juneau about 50 miles north to the Katsahin River. A new ferry terminal would be built there for a short trip to the road system via Haines or Skagway. State estimates from 2014 put the initial construction cost at $574 million. Meanwhile, the State Department of Transportation's final environmental review document on the project is expected this summer. Presumably, it will confirm the governor's no-build decision. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, four Yukon Kuskokwim Delta teens make a film on one of the biggest issues in their region.
I chose climate change because I wanted to know how it was like in the past and how it is now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal summer routes now available to Cordova, Anchorage, and Valdez. Information available at flyraven.com.
Anchorage will hold a special election to fill a newly vacant seat on the assembly. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, in the meantime, West Anchorage will be represented on the body by an interim appointee.
On Tuesday, Assemblymember Tim Steele effectively resigned from the 11-member body, citing serious health issues. West Anchorage residents in neighborhoods like Spinard, Turnagain, and Sand Lake will pick a new representative in a special election that the municipal clerk's office is scheduled for later this summer. Candidates will have a week to file, starting on June 26th. The vote will be conducted by mail, with packets sent out to West Anchorage voters in mid-July and ballots due back by August 7th. So far, two candidates have announced bids to fill the vacant West Anchorage seat. Austin Quinn Davidson directs legal affairs for the Great Land Trusts, an environmental conservation nonprofit, and Sam Moore is an accountant active in Republican politics. It's both candidates' first time running for elected office. But the Assembly decided it won't just wait until the seat is filled. The clerk's office is now taking applications for an interim member who will serve for a little more than a month once the Assembly votes on candidates July 12th. Interested West Anchorage residents have until June 25th to file. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
Activity is picking up in the harbors in Petersburg this week as fishing boats and tenders prepare for the start of several commercial fishing seasons. But optimism is a little scarce on the docks. Fishermen this summer are feeling the effects of reduced catches, low forecasts, and increasing competition from marine mammals. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
The harbors buzz with the sound of power tools, boats loading gear, and coming and going from their stalls. It's time for last-minute projects before hauling crab pots to the fishing grounds or testing nets and training new crew. In South Harbor, Charlie Christensen is readying the Erica Ann for some tendering work in the early summer. Then he'll switch over to seining once pink salmon start coming in. He has a long list of bad news for his fishing season, stretching back to management decisions by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for golden or brown king crab. He also points to whale predation on black cod, lower prices for halibut and black cod, and a cut to the halibut catch by federal fishery managers.
With the reductions, it's taken a lot out of our income. And with this prediction for the salmon season, it's going to jam all the boats into one area, so it's going to split the pie up pretty thin. No, there's nothing really bright about this season at all. And if I was in Petersburg, I'd be kind of concerned about the future economics of this town unless things get better.
For the salmon season, fishery managers forecast an average harvest of 23 million pinks this summer, but don't expect much of that harvest to come from the northern part of the region. The parents of this year's pink salmon spawned in 2016. The catch that year was less than 18.5 million, and the fishery was declared a disaster. Taylor Norheim also runs a salmon tender for Icicle Seafoods, and he's pessimistic about growing populations of marine mammals and their impacts on commercial fishing.
The biggest issue that I see with managing it properly is you got the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which protects all those predators which are eating everything. And I don't understand how the Fish and Game is supposed to manage something like they're going to shut down crabbing early, it sounds like, and then the sea otters are going to move in and eat everything. Well, you can't manage them. Just like you manage wolves for the deer populations and whatnot, you cannot manage sea otters or the, well, maybe sea lions. I don't know what they impact they have, but and the whales especially.
Hatchery chum salmon returns around the region are projected to total more than 9 million, and that could be one bright spot for fishermen this year. Harold Thompson is getting set for the season on board the St. Lazaria, another tender for Icicle Seafoods. He expects to be transporting some of those hatchery chum from the Juneau area.
Well, we're hoping for a good amount of fish up in the Juneau area, which is normally one of the better areas for the gillnetters. And it's we're not going to get much time compared to some years, it sounds like. But I think they might do fairly well if the fish show up and the price is high.
Commercial salmon fisheries around the region are being impacted by historically low returns of king salmon. Gillnetters have delayed season starts and mesh size maximums in the early season to limit the catch of kings returning to southeast rivers. Gillnetters and purse seiners both were scheduled for their first openings Sunday, June 17th. Fish and Game expects 2 to 3 openings for seiners targeting hatchery chums at Hidden Falls on Baranoff Island. The forecast for Hidden Falls chums is just under 600,000 fish. One-third of that is needed for broodstock, leaving just over 400,000 chums for a commercial harvest. Other early season seine openings are planned for hatchery chum salmon returning to Kendrick Bay on southern Prince of Wales Island. Springtime trolling for king salmon has been limited to a few areas around hatchery returns and on the outer coast. Many other areas remain closed to allow wild stock kings to return to their spawning rivers. Trolling opens in a few other areas this month, including some for targeting those hatchery chum runs. And by early June, the spring season catch total for the region had only topped 2,500 Chinook salmon. Meanwhile, others are heading out for a mid-month start to summer Dungeness crabbing. Last year's summer season was shortened by 3 weeks, only the second time since 2000 for a shortened season. The summer catch was 1.3 million pounds, the lowest harvest in over 3 decades. However, a shortened fall season produced a better-than-expected harvest. The crab season length is determined by the catch from the first week of fishing. Fish and Game expects to make that announcement by the end of the month. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
The University of Alaska's Board of Regents will consider plans for a proposed timber sale in the Chilkat Valley next week. The decision on whether or not the board would approve the development and disposal plan was postponed at a meeting last month. Some regents raised concerns about the lack of information on the proposed sale. As KHNS's Henry Leisha reports, the university has been criticized in the past for their public process during land sales.
In March, the University of Alaska announced it was working towards a timber sale on 13,400 acres of land in the Haynesboro. The proposed 10-year negotiated sale would produce 150 million board feet. The Facilities and Land Management Committee for the university's Board of Regents met at the end of May to review the proposed timber sale. At the meeting, Regent Joe Heckman questioned the university's policy on the negotiated sale process and stated that the board was being asked to make a decision with inadequate information.
When you say the brevity of the document is because that is how it's defined in our policy, are we real proud of that policy? You know, it's hard for us to make a decision, a balanced, informed decision when the information is not there.
No specific details have been provided about which areas of the university's lands will be harvested and how the timber would be logged. Vice Chair John Davies suggested the board seek public comment further along in negotiations and submit the final contract to the board for approval. UA Land Management Office Director Christine Klein opposed this idea, saying it could disrupt the sale.
It is not a standard process for the public to be involved in a very technical timber sale negotiated contract. It could put us in a situation where the buyer looks at other markets instead of this one.
Davies' recommendation was voted down 2-1 by the committee, but they did not rule out the possibility of discussing it further when the entire board was present. The university provides a public comment period for all of its timber sales. The deadline for comments on the sale in the Chilkat Valley was extended twice, running until May 22nd. But the Haynesboro Assembly has expressed frustration with the university's public process. In May, the Assembly sent a letter criticizing the format for its open house on the timber sale. They requested the university address concerns and answer residents' questions in public rather than individually. This isn't the first time the university's timber sales have come under scrutiny for lacking transparency. During a previous university timber sale on Mitkoff Island, the Petersburg Borough and the city of Kupernov requested the university suspend the finalization of its contract. In a 2014 letter, the borough claimed the Board of Regents made the decision in the absence of a meaningful public process. The university has not provided specific information about where and how the buyer would harvest timber in the Chilkat Valley, partly because they are engaged in a negotiated sale. Not all terms of the sale will be available until the negotiations are complete. At the open house, the Land Management Office explained that a negotiated sale allows them to secure a purchaser and avoid a deal falling through after years of negotiation. Director Christine Klein said even though it speeds up the sale process, once it is set, they will be able to better address the community's needs.
If we do a negotiated sale, which we can lock in at least the interest in the buyer, then there's room for flexibility to negotiate things that can be done to meet the community's needs.
At its May 31st meeting, the Facilities and Land Management Committee voted to postpone discussion of the development and disposal plan in order to allow more time for university administration to provide a full presentation. UA Public Affairs Vice President Roberta Graham says if the board approves the plan, the university's land management office will begin talks with the buyer. The administration expects to bring essential terms back to the Board of Regents for review and approval. Graham noted that a vital process for exchange of input and information is being established by the UA Land Management Office and the Haynes community through the ongoing development of the Haynes Action Committee, a local committee of stakeholders. The Board of Regents will discuss plans for the proposed sale at a special meeting on June 19th. A live stream of the conversation will be available on the university's website from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. In Haynes, I'm Henry Leisha.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Climate change is slowly disrupting the subsistence lifestyle in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and some of its younger residents are documenting the changes they're seeing through film. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports in Bethel.
In southwestern Alaska, Yupik and Chupik people have subsisted off the land and sea for thousands of years. What our ancestors taught us is our way of life.
That's Nikolai Fisher, one of the four local high school students who made a short documentary film on climate change in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Clayton Mizek is another one of the filmmakers. He's 18 years old from the village of McGorick, west of Bethel.
Plants, animals, they are all changing.
The film documents the changes these students are witnessing. They made the film as part of a two-week workshop hosted by the Lower Kuskokwim School District.
I chose climate change because I wanted to know how it was like in the past and how it is now.
That's Katie Dementiev from Akiak. She's only 14, and even in her short lifespan, she's seen the changes in the weather patterns that leave less and less snow on the ground. This is a frequent theme from the four aspiring filmmakers. Less snow. There's also erosion, something Sam Tinker from Acula has seen grow worse.
The biggest change in my 16 years was, I think, the erosion on the side of the river. The land was starting to fall apart into the water, and the river was almost high enough that it's around your knees, waist area.
Like most residents who grow up in the YK Delta, these four students practice the subsistence lifestyle that was passed down for millennia. But now that lifestyle is under threat as climate change affects animal migratory behavior. Tinker says he's seen fewer ptarmigan and Canada geese. Nikolai Fisher from Napaskiak has seen it too.
I've noticed the moose going to the coast, the geese heading more and more out of our villages.
For these four filmmakers, making the documentary is a way to wake up their communities, Tinker says, and help them find a solution.
Because I want to spark the mind of the people on why climate change is so important and the subsistence way of living off our land, off the land, is so important to the Yupik and Chupik people.
A total of 12 students completed three films on different topics during the workshop. The videos can be found online at the YouTube channel LKSD Media. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
When Seattle-based sculptor John Grotti first headed to the Arctic, he was searching for the northernmost tree he could find. But along the way, he was struck by something else. Hills in an otherwise flat and open landscape. Those hills, called Pingos, inspired his sculpture, Murmur, which opens at the Anchorage Museum tomorrow. As Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry reports, the new sculpture is more than something to look at. It's an interactive, mixed-reality experience that can educate urban Alaskans about the northernmost part of our state.
I'm a little bit surprised by how many people weren't familiar with what a pingo was. And I think that's because a lot of Alaskans aren't up in the Arctic.
Sculptor John Grotti and his team are putting the finishing touches on his creation as they get ready for tomorrow's opening. To design the sculpture, Grotti spent 3.5 days camping on top of a pingo and then used a drone to map it from above.
So I think of a pingo as like a skin condition in the landscape.
The sculpture's scale is impressive. The mound is 42 feet tall and almost as wide. It's light brown and formed with different size panels made of salvaged Alaskan yellow cedar. They're curved and splattered with small holes. Grotti describes the structure.
When that artificial light's turned off, you get all of this shadow play, and the shadows are overlapping one another. And then as these panels all start to unfold, all of those shadows start moving all over the place.
A member of his team rides a boom lift and peers in through the pingo's top. Others sit around the edges, staring at computers. Three more work on the inside, testing out the sculpture's moving walls. trip to the Arctic through the Anchorage Museum's Polar Lab program inspired Grotti to make the sculpture. Pingos form when trapped water beneath the ground freezes, and hydrostatic pressure forces the mounds slowly upward.
And each year, it's cycling through and growing incrementally, so it could take 1,000 years before a mound grows just below the permafrost that might be 75 feet tall.
Their cores are made of ice. As the ice melts, eventually pingos collapse, forming scars in the landscape.
They're a very moving phenomena, and I think that they're something that we can watch to sort of see how the climate's changing in the Arctic.
But it's not just a pingo that Grotti was looking to simulate for the exhibit. While paddling toward one on the Noatak, he watched a flock of birds create a murmuration that looked like the profile of a pingo. Murmurations are when birds dance together in massive moving shapes. Most people associate them with starlings.
Seeing the birds in this very ephemeral, fleeting moment, and then comparing it to this glacial rise of a pingo over hundreds of years, I kind of wanted to do two things. I wanted to do two things that I can't do. I wanted to be in the middle of a murmur of birds, and I wanted to be inside a solid ice core of a pingo. So bringing those two things together with one sculpture was the initial drive.
Hence the name Murmur. Grotti also wanted to give visitors a better sense of the Arctic environment through sounds and through visuals. To do that, he brought in Riley Donovan, a new media artist. Here's Donovan.
Some of what you'll see are puddles from the marshlands of the region. You'll also see mosquitoes flocking and very delicate fungi and flowers.
The exhibit uses something called augmented reality. Visitors wear HoloLens headsets that add sounds and holograms to their surroundings. Inside the pingo, a holographic ice core extends beneath the floor.
As you traverse the terrain, you actually start illuminating and revealing holograms that populate the floor space.
Grotti and Donovan worked with a team of 20 to create the exhibit, including a computer programmer and a mechanical engineer. The exhibit will be at the Anchorage Museum until September before it travels internationally. It'll return to the museum in 2020, where it will hang upside down from the ceiling, meant to symbolize the collapse of a pingo.
What's most important to me is that people come into the experience and they're able to project their own ideas about what that landscape might mean and how it is to interact with other people within the exhibit as well.
In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Aaron Bolton in Homer, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Erin McKinstry in Anchorage, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Henry Leisha in Haines, and Christy Schallenberger in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.